Okay, my name is Daniel Schur, and I'm here with Adrian Horn in Norfolk County. The date is the 5th of December 2007. Adrian, before we begin, I'd just like to make sure that we've spoken over the informed consent.
Yes,
And
yes.
do you have any questions about
Nope,
that? And we've
all
spoken
okay.
about the legal release, and you understand all that.
Yep, all
Okay,
signed up.
great, great. Okay, well, then let's get started. Before we get into the kind of meat of the interview, I'd just like to talk a little bit about your biography.
Yep.
Could you describe your position now and what exactly you do, what your responsibilities are, and that sort of thing?
Well, I'm a former chief police officer. I had a career in the police service in the UK. I finished up as assistant chief constable. I left the police service in 1994, set up my own company, which is involved in the collation, analysis, and dissemination of information on policing in the UK. And my particular input into all of that, into the business, as a consultant in working with police forces in obviously developing and post-conflict countries.
Okay. And within police work, do you have a particular speciality? Is there something that you would consider to be your main personal focus, some area that you'd like to work on?
No, my career gave me experience in all aspects of policing in the UK. I was sort of selected early on for accelerated promotion, so consequently I was exposed and to all aspects of policing. So, but I'm very much a more a practically based individual rather than theoretical, and I do have a particular interest in the community-based type policing. And what you can do with that in these sorts of countries, as I think that's a solution to many of the problems.
Okay, well, we certainly hope to talk about that in
Yeah.
the interview. And if it's all right with you, I'd like to kind of jump into the kind of
Yeah,
functional
no,
areas
fine.
that we're interested in. The first thing I'd like to talk about is recruitment and developing effective recruitment strategies. Is this something that you have any experience of?
Yeah, in Sierra Leone, we were faced with this problem where we had a quite a large police force on paper, but in terms of the people who could actually undertake policing duties, it was pretty small. And one of the problems in countries like Sierra Leone, developing countries, and police forces, actually, when you see police officers on the street, they're not necessarily policemen in the true sense of the word. For example, in Sierra Leone, all the mechanics, all the labourers, all the technical people were police officers, where in sort of modern police force, professional police forces, they would actually be civilians. So one of the aspects you've got to consider is separating out the civilian support side of a police service from the actual people who deliver the police service themselves. So we actually had to recruit a lot of people in Sierra Leone. One of the reasons was to make sure the police force was ready and trained to deal with the drawdown of the UN contingent, for example. They had about 17 odd thousand UN personnel in Sierra Leone, and before they could draw down, before they could withdraw, we had to make sure that we had something there to fill the vacuum when they pulled out. So we had to have a very intensive recruitment drive to build the police force up to about 9,500 over a period of 2 or 3 years. And one of the, well, several issues you actually have to address. Let's get straight into corruption. In post-conflict countries, you find that people want to be police officers, and one of the reasons is that they actually have power, so they can actually use corrupt ways in which to get money. So if they're not paid properly, obviously somebody in uniform in power, whether it be on a traffic duty or whether it be dealing with crime or whatever, is in a very strong position to get money. So we had to address those sorts of issues. So integrity, background checks on the individual were very, very important. The sort of issues that you don't expect but you became very quickly familiar with is, for example, if you ask for a certain standard of academic achievement, that they will bring in forged documents. They will bring in forged exam results, forged attainment certificates for education, etc., which they could buy. And you also found, as you dug a bit deeper, that at school, you know, corruptly, they could get better marks than perhaps what they were deserving. So you had to introduce tests, whereas they said they can read and write. You had to introduce tests to make sure that they could read and write and they had a basic education. So there's all sorts of practical issues you have to address to make sure, first of all, that you get people coming into the service who are literate. And in the Congo, for example, where I'm working at the moment, the DRC, it's something like 50-60% of the police force are illiterate, so the Inspector General says. So you've got to address issues like that. You can't suddenly get rid of that number of people. I mean, first of all, they've joined the police service, been accepted, and they're police officers. So you've got to care for them, and you've got to make sure that there's some sort of exit strategy. But at the same time, you've got to make sure that the job is attractive enough that people are joining it for the right reasons and have the necessary levels of education, levels of reading and writing, and are joining it for the right reason. The other side of that is that that there are, I find, within most police forces, there is a critical mass of people who are extremely well educated, want the force to change, want the service to develop, because that's what they join for, and are willing to do it. And that often is a great encouragement to somebody who's working this area to know that there are people there who are willing to make things happen and want to do it for the right reasons. So as a recruitment policy, you had to first of all select, and you had to set, well, before you even did that, you need to come up with job descriptions. You need to come up with the competencies that are required for the people who are joining the police. You had to make sure that the people were acceptable, because obviously you're going to get tribal, you're going to ethnic, you're going to get all sorts of issues like that creeping in. And if you want to do some checks on whether people are acceptable, then you had to have some sort of system whereby, particularly if they're coming from villages, where perhaps the chief gives some sort of reference for the individual, which can be checked, and just to make sure you get the right quality of people sort of applying to join the job. The other aspect of it is having the training infrastructure to actually cope with this number of people. So something we had to do, again, back to Sierra Leone, that we had to quickly put together a training school that could actually train and... had to train and accommodate 600-700 students at any one time. So there's a big investment in putting in proper proper classroom facilities, proper sleeping facilities, all those sorts of things. You then have to review the courses, because you find that there is a lot of, for example, training in the use of firearms, which people will never use. Sierra Leone, the police force is basically non-armed. The armed part of the police force is a separate body altogether. So the policemen are not armed. So because you're inheriting a legacy system that goes back to colonial days. There was a lot of drill, a lot of arms training and all the rest of it. And you have to ask the question, is this necessary? If we're trying to train a lot of people up quickly in how to be a police officer or the basics of how to be a police officer, do they really need to know how to drill and to present arms and put on marvellous parades? So we were able to cut the size of the course down, the length of the course down, by looking through all that stuff and chucking out what isn't really relevant and concentrating on the stuff which is relevant. And you have to introduce things like human rights. Obviously, human rights is a major issue, so you have to train people in human rights, their responsibilities, all those sorts of issues. And it was pretty effective. So we got the course down from about 6 months, the initial course, I think it was, down to about 14 weeks. 12-14 weeks, and at the end of the time, police officers came out with the basic knowledge that they required and the basic skills that they required. then you enter another big problem. And it follows on to talk about this, that after about 18 months, it's all very well training somebody to do something, but then comes the question, how is that training applied when you get out on the ground, when you go to the station that you're assigned to? How do you apply the training you've been given in the training environment to how you actually do the job on the ground? And after we peel back all these layers of issues and problems as we tried to develop the Sierra Leone police, something suddenly leapt out, and that was the fact that and the best way to describe this is to ask people, how did you learn to do your job? Most people will say, well, I worked with this person, I worked with that person, they showed me how to fill a form in, or they showed me how to, or they came with me when I went to interview somebody, or whatever. You learn from other people, not necessarily from training. So you then ask the question, well, are those people there to teach you how to do the job? And if you look at a country, and most of the conflict, post-conflict countries we're talking about are ones where they gained independence in the 60s, when you probably had a good basic policing system up until that point. So the people who used to teach the new recruits how to handle a prisoner, for example, or how to fill in a prisoner form, or how to take a statement, simply are not there. So therefore, there is no organisational memory, knowledge bank, in which to train people up how to do the job on the ground. And that became a major, major problem. And we had to introduce a strategy, which we call Back to Basics, of actually teaching people on the ground how to do those basic things. They may sound very simple, like keeping a pocketbook or taking a statement, or filling a form in that registers how a prisoner is dealt with, etc. But absolutely essential, because these are the basic day-to-day tasks that police officers have to undertake. And we introduced a very good system in liaison with the UN, who had lots of policemen out there on the ground. Whereas for 6 weeks, everybody would train everybody on the ground as much as they possibly could on a small number of basic essential tasks. But then we struck another problem. What we found was, because within, particularly when you're talking about the United Nations and the civilian police component, that they come from many different countries themselves. I think we had something like 17 different countries represented. So we had to train them up as well in the Sierra Leone way of doing things, rather than the various countries' way of doing things. And so we had to train the police officers, the UN police officers, on how to do these things the Sierra Leone way, together with the necessary forms and what have you. So they would come in, we'd have a big training session, they would go out to various police stations and help train up policemen on how to do things, because you had to rebuild that institutional memory knowledge bank of just the basics. Very, very interesting problem we came across, and no doubt everybody else comes across. I'm currently working, as I say, in the DRC. Same problem. New police force. Lots of old systems and procedures, but everybody's forgotten them. Very little access to the written word in the police stations. So all that's got to be replaced and got to be rebuilt.
There's a lot of things that I'd like to pick up on there. If you don't mind, I'd like to pull it back a little bit to some things you mentioned when you were talking about your recruitment strategy. Firstly, you mentioned that, you know, actually drawing up job descriptions and putting the word out. How did you do that? Was that over radio and local newspapers? How did you get the word out that you were recruiting police?
Very much it comes by word of mouth. We wanted to make sure that we recruited across the country, not just in Freetown or whatever. Radio, alongside this, one of the first things we did in Sierra Leone was build a media department. Now, it may sound strange to some people that why is that a priority? Well, it is a priority for several reasons, because you've got to communicate what's going on both internally and externally. So we had a consultant there, Stuart, who set up a media department, did the training, gave them the basic equipment. And for example, one of the things we introduced, because you just could not rely on the press at that time, I mean, that they would put in stories which were paid by people who wanted a particular story to go in, or they were just interested in the headlines or whatever. So it's totally unreliable. They would not give the right story. Solution? We got the police. We introduced a police newspaper. So once a month, a police newspaper went out, and there were enough copies to go around the country so that people could obviously read them and share them and whatever. And through that, we were able to announce that, you know, we've got particular recruitment policies, recruitment going on or whatever. So the word soon got about. And the UN helped enormously in managing that. So we would ask adverts go in the newspapers, things on the radio, saying that recruiting's starting. Apply, which they did. They could get the forms from the police station. And then there was a filtering process, and we went from there. Mm-hmm. So in support of a lot of this stuff, you can't just say, we're going to recruit. You've got to have an infrastructure in place to deal with that. And part of that infrastructure is internal, external communication.
Okay, yeah, no, that makes sense. Another thing I wanted to pick up on was this idea of making sure that the recruits you were getting were acceptable from a kind of community perspective. And you said sometimes you'd get references from the local local chiefs.
Chief,
or,
yeah.
How did, and you said you set up a kind of system to do this and then to verify the information that you got from these chiefs. How did that work? I mean, what was the kind of process there?
Yeah, the UN, because the UN officers, civilian police component, were locally based, they handled a lot of that and they filtered a lot of that. And we had a another consultant named Peter Kinson, who sort of was overseeing the whole training thing. But basically, I mean, it's pretty simple. You couldn't have anything too complicated because of the communications problems and all the rest of it. But when anybody applied for a job, they had to fill in the application form and they had to produce references. I don't know whether it happened, but there was, I can't remember if it was for the police or for the army, but there was a system debated about putting pictures up in villages and saying, anybody got an objection to this person type of thing, you know, give us some feedback. I'm not sure how that went, but that was one of the ideas that was mooted. But basically, you had references, and as far as possible, those references were checked with the person who wrote them. As I say, going back to the corruption bit, it's very easy for somebody to get a teacher to say, oh, this guy's the best thing since sliced bread. You know, when you go and talk to them, they say, oh, no, you know, perhaps he's not the right person. So there was a filtering process. I mean, it's not going to be exact like it is in the UK or somewhere like that. With reference checks to the criminal records, because one of the problems we had was that all the criminal records were destroyed in round about 2000 when the CID headquarters was burnt down. So there were no fingerprints, there were no CRO checks, criminal record checks. So you had to rely on people's memory and also on you know, comments you may get from the villages or whatever where these people live. But generally it worked pretty well. We occasionally you found that, particularly in the early stages, until people realised that, you know, we are not going to accept corruption when this has got to be done properly. There were the odd occasion where sort of halfway through the course somebody suddenly found out that the person couldn't read and write, and there was some scam going on where somebody else was writing the exam paper, or there was collusion with one of the trainers or whatever. But that soon got eliminated, because one of the things you've got to be pretty aware of is all the corrupt practices and scams that exist, and you just try and design them out.
Did you make use of any sort of trial periods or probationary periods to try and to make sure you were weeding those sorts of scams out?
The I think it was 2 years. There was certainly a probationary period built in, because Sierra Leone, for example, was built on the old British system. That was fairly well accepted that in the first couple of years, if the officer didn't perform, then you could get rid of them. I'm not quite sure how this finished up, but within the old regulations, people had to reapply for their job after 5 years or 5 year periods, and that was a point where somebody could, you know, say, well, sorry, we don't want you anymore. You can go, but it had to be handled very gently. I mean, this you were talking about a legacy police force. You were talking about people who've been through horrendous times. I mean, you didn't just get rid of people. We had to consider things like, well, if they can't read and write, if they're illiterate, what areas of the police force can they actually work in? We don't want to get rid of people just for the sake of getting rid of people. And for example, if you're guarding premises or guarding, Parliament or whatever, you don't necessarily have to be literate to do that. So therefore, you could make good use of the individuals, and gainfully employ them. Mm. So it's several years on in the build-up of an organisation like that before you can have really strict sort of policies like that. And you've got to think about the welfare of the individuals.
Yeah, sure. You've mentioned corruption and these sort of scams a few times as being a major obstacle to designing this type of effective recruitment strategy. Would you mind talking about some other obstacles you encountered?
Well, on the recruitment side?
On the recruitment side, yeah.
You've got things like practical considerations, like you've got to win the hearts and minds of the senior officers for a start. Mm-hmm. Let's take something simple like the drill sessions. Because senior officers would have been through that system, because they had quite a lot of pride in the training school that they had just outside Freetown, and because this is how they did it, it was actually quite difficult to convince some of them that we need a change. You know, why spend half of a 6 month course on teaching drill and teaching how to handle a weapon when the guys aren't going to have access? The guys and girls aren't going to have access to the weapons out on the ground. So over time, we managed to convince them, because at the end of the day, it's not what we want. It's not what the UK wants. It's not what any other country wants. It's what Sierra Leone wants. So they've got to decide what sort of training system, what sort of police force, whatever, that they want. And then you have to train to that. Now, that's extremely important, because if you're going to impose something, it's simply not going to be sustainable. It's not going to work. But over time, talking to people, they began to realise, well, yeah, there is a lot of wasted time. We've got a lot of people to train up quickly. What can we eliminate which isn't 100% successful? What do we need to build into the training course? What are the themes, etc.? And alongside that, at the end of the day, we introduced a policing system with the police officers and with the people of Sierra Leone, which is called local police policing. So you had to make sure that all the training was directed at this concept of community-based policing, which again required education of the trainers, education of the senior officers about headquarters supports the policing on the ground, not the policing on the ground supports headquarters. So we had to turn the whole thing upside down. So you can imagine a triangle where before it was sitting on the base, and the base was the policemen on the ground, the traffic, etc., all supporting the pinnacle, which was headquarters. Turn it upside down, so the pinnacle's at the bottom and the base is at the top, and that's what should happen. It's about delivering policing service on the ground. Also, we had to retrain the trainers. So quite a bit of effort and a bit of money was spent on bringing people over to train the trainers in modern ways of delivering training, more practically based, less of the chalk and talk, where people would just like would just write out the lesson notes on the blackboard, and everybody else would copy in classes of 100, you know, 100 odd people. Yeah, not good. So it was about more discussion, about more participation, about more understanding of why we are doing this, what the new style of policing is going to be, and how do you actually do that on the ground. So much more practically based, modern methods of training, and working to a concept rather than just sort of rote learning of the lesson notes. So it was quite a radical change. And you had to change... The senior officer there, obviously brought up on the old system, they had to understand and encapsulate why this was necessary.
Can I ask, you mentioned that you developed themes that were perhaps more relevant than these kind of drills and that sort of thing. What were these themes? I mean, could you talk about the curriculum of the training?
I didn't handle that personally, so Peter Kinson would be the guy to talk about that, but... It's things like introducing human rights into just about everything that you dealt with. You know, basic human right is that you don't arrest somebody without telling them why they've been arrested in the language they understand, etc. So, you know, they've got to understand where this comes from. So that then leads on to how do you arrest somebody, practical demonstrations. Understanding the law so you can say, well, I have a power of arrest under this act, I'm arresting you for this, and then given the caution. So just basic, proper, standard police techniques on how to deal with people properly, how to arrest people properly, how to take statements properly. And a lot of bad practices had built up. And we had to take, particularly the detective branch, you had to take them back to retrain them on things like the judge's rules, which were the rules which governed how you handled and how you interviewed and when you could interview prisoners, for example. And that was interesting exercise. We set up a major robbery squad, major crime squad, small number of people, but again trained by a detective from the UK who knew the law, the judge's rules, and was a very experienced detective, and trained them up on the proper way to take a statement, the proper way to gather evidence, the fact that you can go out and interview people and as witnesses, all this sort of thing. And of course, when some of the cases started coming to court, which were first class cases, because this was a practice that had become abused or wasn't used for many, many years, of course, you know, the magistrates will look back and the solicitors will look back and say, oh, what is this new thing? Of course, what you had to explain to them, well, this isn't new, this is how it should be done. It's just that bad practices have crept in over the years, and you've got to get back to what the law supports and not what you think should be done. Mm. So there were a number of good examples of like that.
We've touched on this a bit, but I wonder if you could talk in some more detail about the modern methods of police training. So you said you had demonstrations and these sorts of
talks. Yeah, you need to practically base them, and you need to allow the people to discuss the issues. As I say, not stand at a board and write it all out, but say, right, well, this is a law, right? Anybody give me an example? How are you going to handle with this? What if this happens? How are you going to deal with that? So far more interactive, far more the students being involved in discussing the issues and problems and understanding why certain things have to happen and why we have to handle prisoners in this way, etc., etc. And all through was this concept of, well, this is the new style of policing. This is local needs policing. This is what you're going to have to do in this area to make sure that you're dealing with this on the ground. So it's things like devolved responsibility. So in other words, that police officers on the ground have the confidence to make decisions. And of course, on top of that, you had management training with the middle ranks. That was an important issue as well, and that was done locally with management training people within Sierra Leone, and that was very useful to start them thinking more about management and how you manage people properly, how you get the best out of people, how an organisation works, all those sorts of things. And there was specialist training as well, particularly, for example, in the women and child abuse area, that we had people come over who were specialists in this area to make sure that police officers, there were enough police officers trained who could deal properly and respond properly to women who had been raped, for example, or complaining about domestic violence, these sorts of issues.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to get back to the management in a little while. For now, I just wanted to ask, you said you had people come over to handle the specialist training. So who primarily conducted the training?
Experienced people. I mean, in the case of the women and children, some very experienced people, not just police officers, but people who have been involved in dealing these sorts of issues in the UK. We used UK people for this. And it was a combination of people experienced on the social welfare side, people have been experienced before in setting up things like sexual abuse referral centres, and a woman detective who had been working in this area for some time. We also had to address the medical issues, for example, medical examination, which was a new dimension. So you had to find counterparts on the medical side, doctors who were willing to examine female patients, for example, and be prepared and trained to give evidence and make statements and do the necessary checks.
Okay, and the training was all conducted in English? Or?
Yeah, see, I mean, the benefit of Sierra Leone, of course, it's an English-speaking, English is the main language, so we were able to do it all in English, so language wasn't a particular problem there.
Yeah, okay. I understood there was some sort of local patois that's quite
interesting. Oh, yes, yeah, you've got Creole and you got five or six tribal language, but generally everybody spoke English, so it wasn't a problem.
Okay, okay.
I mean, all the law was in English, all the written work was in English.
Okay. And having done the training, what sort of follow-up procedures were there to make sure that the training was having its intended effect?
That's interesting. That's important. As I said before, there's no point training somebody if you don't monitor the application on the ground. So what we built up was that made sure that people came back to go and check on the ground what was happening, to work on the ground. And we work with the people who were trained to make sure that they were applying what they've been trained to do. And that raises a very interesting area, and it's about the longevity of projects. it's no point going in and doing something. We talked before about vehicles. There's no point going into a country and thinking, right, they need vehicles, which they obviously will do, giving them 100 vehicles and think job done and coming away, because they'll last a few months and that will be it. Total waste of money. So we were able to take a longer term view, and also the British government took a longer term view. So Claire Short, for example, signed a memorandum of understanding with the president that says, we'll basically support you for 10 years, you know, subject to certain conditions. So we had a longer-term view. And individually, we were there for some time. So we were there for several years. So it gave a great deal of confidence to the officers who wanted to make a change to stick with it. And that was a major decision. I'm going off the track here for a bit, but that was a major decision for some of the senior officers as to whether to commit to this process of change. Because historically, whenever there was a coup attempt or whatever, the police were subject to quite violent and horrendous abuse by the rebels or whatever, because the police were always seen as an arm of the government that was in power, so therefore they were the natural target. So for a senior officer, politically, socially, whatever, to say, right, okay, I'm going to work with these guys who have come in and I'm going to be part of this police reform, that's a major decision on their part. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we were there long term and we were able to tell them that there was long support, it gave them the confidence to work with us generally work with us, not just say so, but actually work with us to put these changes in place and to develop the police force. Major issue. But going back to the vehicles, I mean, we supplied something like 400, 450-odd Land Rovers, a lot of motorbikes, all this sort of thing. But we didn't do it all in once, and we spent a lot of time concentrating on setting up a proper garage, training the technicians and engineers up so they could work on the vehicles properly. Train the engineers up so they could work on the vehicles properly, making sure they had the proper tools to do the job, making sure they had the spares to do the job, making sure they had the facilities on which to properly maintain these vehicles. Also, driving a Land Rover may seem quite simple, but if you don't drive it properly and use the right gears, you can soon destroy the thing. So therefore, driver training was an important issue. We very soon discovered that something like 15% of the force budget was being stolen through misuse of fuel. So we quickly implemented some some management, simple management tools to enable us to proper monitor the use of the vehicles. Things like logbooks, things like proper records at the fuel pumps, and checking that. One of my pet phrases in Sierra Leone was management by walking about. The only way you could check these things was to walk to the fuel pumps, ask to see the stuff, ask to see the records, and do some physical checks, which in itself cut out a lot of the problems and a lot of the abuse. So, quite interesting. But we very quickly, within about 24 hours after, and what happened there was I was driving around where the garages are, and I saw a guy behind one of the Mercedes ambulances, second-hand Mercedes ambulance we supplied, and he was siphoning fuel. So he was duly dealt with. And then I went to the fuel pumps, and there was a guy with a motorbike. It was not his lucky day, but he'd just put in 2 gallons of fuel into Honda 125 XLS, which were the motorbikes that we supplied. And, of course, the attendant had written 2 gallons of fuel in the pump. I said, "Well, how come you put 2 gallons in?" "Oh, that's what it takes." I says, "Yeah, well, let's just have a look at the handbook." "Right, maximum capacity of fuel, including reserve, 1.7 gallons. "Ah, yes, well, we have to round it up." "Okay, so you put in, what, just over a gallon?" "Yes." "But you round it up to 2 gallons, yeah. So how many motorbikes come through here a day?" "Oh, I don't know, 40, 50. So what happens at the end of the day when your tally on your log sheet doesn't tally with the pump meter?" "Ah, well, we have to use the petrol somewhere else." So basically, there was a great big fiddle going on with this. Then, of course, we introduced logbooks with the Land Rovers, and very quickly discovered that some of the Land Rovers turned about 4 or 5 miles to the gallon. But the logbook soon solved that, except that suddenly we had a lot of speedometer cables were broken, so that the speedo didn't work and therefore didn't recall the mileage. So you have to be aware of all these things, and you have to deal with them. So you can never totally eliminate all these problems, but you can quickly build quite a resistance to some of these problems. But you're faced with an enormous problem. You have police officers working in these areas who get paid a pittance. I mean, minimal wages, not enough to live on, and certainly not enough to feed the family and all the rest of it. And they're in a position of power. So when we first went out, me and Keith went out to Sierra Leone in 98, about between 40% and 50% of it, I think, of the police force were in traffic, and they had these white sleeves, and their job, they thought, was to direct the traffic. But of course, being on a traffic point and stopping vehicles and all the rest of it was easy access to some Leons, because it was a money making job. To the extent that people would buy their own white sleeves, even though they weren't in traffic, or they would rent some white sleeves in order to go and do some traffic duty to bump the wages up. So you had to deal with these sorts of issues. Knowing that, if you really became tight on corruption and arrest everybody you saw taking money, you wouldn't have a police service. But until such and often there wasn't much you could do about it, until such time you could actually increase the wages or at least make sure that they had some a food allowance or whatever. So it's actually morally quite difficult because in theory, and these people need to be stopped, but in practice they couldn't live without it. So you had to strike a balance between reality and theory.
So you mentioned a food allowance. What other sort of balances did you strike?
Well, one of the things we did to look after the welfare of the officers was to make sure they had a police hospital, for example, at King Tom, which is in Freetown, was to make sure they had the drugs there. Of course, the buying anti-malarial drugs or vitamin supplements or something like that for the most common and majority of diseases was actually very small money. You could buy the things in tubs of 10,000 and through the World Health Organization, I think it was, you could buy boxes of drugs for that particular the area, the country in which you're working. So you could actually fill the hospital with drugs and make sure they got proper treatment. You could make sure that they had disinfectant to clean the wards. I mean, very simple stuff that doesn't cost a lot of money, but enables, has quite a dramatic effect on the health and welfare of people. And it wasn't just in Freetown. In other areas, we introduced some clinics and made sure that there was some either a nurse or a doctor or whatever available to cope with police officers as well as everybody else. Mm-hmm. Interesting thing we did in one of the villages outside Freetown, or one of the main towns outside Freetown, is we had to build a new police station or refurbish a new police station. And one of the senior officers from the Sierra Leone police came up with the idea, well, why don't we build a community hall as well? And very quickly, the town people supplied the labour, we as a project supplied the material, and they built a new communal hall, which is used for police training or for a village meeting. We put a clinic on it, we dug a well, put clean water in, and generally it became a kind of centrepiece of the town, a meeting place that involved the police and all the rest of it, and it did a great deal to build up this relationship between the police and the people, and they felt very much part of the whole thing because they'd actually provided the labour and a lot of the support work to get this thing built. And all it cost us was the material, which was not expensive. Hmm. So it was an extremely good idea. Worked very well.
Was that something that you replicated elsewhere?
Yeah, we tried to replicate that in a number of places, but it rather than us do it, I mean, it was an idea, we said to the police, look, this works. We'll support you with material. We'll support you with tin sheets for the roof or what have you. You go away and do what you can. And in some areas, it was replicated. In some of the barracks, for example, in Freetown, policemen can't generally afford to live outside barracks. The toilet facilities needed building in some cases, refurbishing in others. We as a project supplied some cesspit emptiers, which were a tractor, simple technology, a tractor and a vacuum tank, vacuum trailer, to suck the stuff out of the cesspits and clean them out. And we also said we would fund the materials to build new cesspits and new toilets. But you as barracks, because there's lots of people there, lots of quite fit young men, for example, you dig the holes, you do the building. And in most places, they grasped the opportunity and for themselves developed good toilets, good cesspits. One or two places they said, oh, you need to pay us, you need to do it. Say, no, we're not paying you, this is for your own benefit. We'll provide the materials, but we're not going to pay you to do the labour. You sort yourselves out. So one or two places was a bit more difficult, but generally people grasped the opportunity and did it for themselves, which is the best way to make sure that that the thing will continue and there'd be some sustainability with it.
Definitely. Just talking about this kind of different approaches or different strategies in different areas, I was wondering if I could bring it back to the training issue. Was the same training done all around the country, or was there a central training base where officers from all over the country were kind of routed through? How did that aspect work?
I think I'm right in saying that all the initial training was done in Freetown, but we also had training centres in Bow and in Kenema, in other places. Again, you have to address the balance. In the Congo, for example, it will be very different. The training schools and the training classrooms will have to be built and developed, and some of that has gone on, because the distance in between and the lack of the impossibility of anything other than air travel between Lubumbashi or Goma or Bukavu or whatever and Kinshasa. So you have to decentralise. So you have to look at the country you're dealing with. In Sierra Leone, it's much easier. You have a simple road network. It's not a big country. DRC is completely the opposite. I think you can fit Sierra Leone something like 22 times into the DRC. It gives you some idea of the size of the place. So I think the point about all of that is that you have to understand the environment in which you're working, and you have to work with the local police force, etc., to come up with a solution that suits their environment and what they need, not say, yeah, we need central training, because in some places it'll work, some places it won't work. So you have to work all that through. Mm-hmm. But as I say, the other thing we introduced in Sierra Leone, which was very effective, was what we call peripatetic trainers. Mm-hmm. So in other words, we trained them as trainers, and then as part of the ongoing training, they were on a motorbike, so they would go to a local police station, do some training locally, and then go on to the next place and do the same training in another smaller town, what have you, which was a much more cost-effective way of doing it, and helped with the continuity of the whole training thing.
And were they in specific areas of training? Or?
No, general trainers. General training.
Another thing I wanted to follow up on, you mentioned this problem of police officers who maybe had been police officers for a while and it turned out that they were illiterate, and so you had to find specific jobs for them. Did you have any kind of basic reading and writing training to address this issue? Because that's something we've heard quite a few times, that just basic reading and writing is not given enough emphasis in training programs.
Yeah. In McKenney, for example, we used to go and visit there, and the local police themselves had realised, obviously, that this was a problem, and had set up a little classroom and were given some basic training in reading and writing. It's nice to think, let's train the illiterate how to read and write. We're not educationalists, and to train somebody to read and write to the standard that you would need to be to read law, for example, or to write a statement, is quite a high standard. So that's going to take a long time to achieve, and you have to balance the what would be nice to train people up to read and write against, we need policemen now who can do the job. Is this really a job of the police? So you need to look for partnerships with schools and stuff like that. And it's a long term commitment. I mean, you know how long it takes you to learn how to read and write properly from 5 years old through to 11, 12, 13 before you become quite proficient in writing at the standard that you need to do for a police officer. So you have to ask the question, is it actually something we can do? Personally, I think it's very difficult. At the same time, you can't just sack somebody. You have to find ways to deal with that issue and deal with that problem.
Okay. There's one last thing I wanted to ask you about training, and that was, you mentioned these peripatetic trainers, which was quite a good kind of cost-saving measure. Were there any other cost-saving devices that you employed to reduce the overall cost of training?
There's not a lot more you could do because it's quite, training's expensive. I mean, you've got to accommodate people. You've got to give them the proper training facilities. You've got to feed people. You can imagine feeding, 600 people at a time that we were doing, and the feeding, the cooking's all done on sort of log fires with great big cooking pots. I mean, it was as basic as that, but it worked. So you couldn't save any more costs on that. I mean, simple things like, we're all used to using whiteboards and whiteboard markers. Well, expensive. Where do you get replacement from when the first supply goes in, 6 months' time? So go back to basics. Blackboard and chalk is the cheapest way in which you can have a visual display. So use it. So these sorts of things that you build in, you're always thinking, right, what's professional and what the facilities that are needed, but then what is the best way to do that? Mm-hmm. And, blackboard and white chalk is obviously a simple solution to that problem. And you can extend that to all sorts of things. Printing, everybody wants colour printers. Colour printers are very expensive to run and manage. What happens when the ink jet goes? What happens when the expensive, toner cartridges go? You can't replace them. They cost money. So keep it simple. Keep it basic. Good, simple, black and white laser printer that you know is going to be reliable and it's the cheapest thing to run if you're going to introduce something like that. So it's those sorts of bicycles. We supplied something like 500 bicycles. Cost little to maintain, can be maintained locally, mm-hmm. but gives the police officer some mobility. But in terms of training, and I'm just trying to think if there's anything else that leaps out. The peripatetic training was extremely good. Obviously, the some of the UN CIVPOL guys got involved in training. Somebody came and suggested computer-based training, which would be excellent. The trouble is, if there's no electricity, you can't do it, and that was the case in the majority of cases. So whilst you think about and consider these things, and perhaps in the future they're going to be a good way of training, going into a country which is coming out of a war, or in this case was in a war, some of the things you have to put to one side and think about the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Well, we're at 52 minutes, and I'd like to suggest we take a
little bit of a break now. Yeah, great. Gone. Not running on.
Okay. Okay, this is part two of the interview with Adrian Horn. We've heard a lot of good stuff about recruitment and training, and now we're going to speak a bit more about management and local needs policing. Firstly, let's talk about internal management. Have you ever assisted? I mean, in Sierra Leone, did you assist at least with processes to strengthen internal management?
Yes, we had to do a lot of work on that. You've got to remember that the old management had obviously developed over the years, and in some cases was quite corrupt. Didn't want to move forward for whatever reason. We had to find some solutions to that. The other thing to realise is that within the organisation were a fair number of people who wanted to do the right thing, who knew what to do, who were extremely well educated, in some cases educated in other countries, in some cases holding relevant police degrees, but hadn't been able to get through the system. Again, for all sorts of reasons, politics, nepotism, all the wrong reasons as to why people who are able and capable can't actually get in the position to make themselves effective. And you've got a thing in Sierra Leone called the pull him down syndrome. If anybody down below showed some spark of life and started bubbling to the surface, if he wasn't doing it for the reasons that the bosses wanted, they were quickly pulled down and didn't go anywhere. So you get quite a bit of frustration in some of the junior ranks. One of the first things we did when we got there was we sent a letter from the then Inspector General, or the person standing in for the Inspector General, explaining a bit what was going on in terms of the change process and what may lay in front of them for the future. And leaving half a sheet of A4 paper clear so they could write back to us, because paper was a problem. Nobody had access to paper. And we got hundreds back, nearly all, in fact all, from the junior and the lower ranks and junior ranks, and some from the middle ranks. And these were people who were telling us, for goodness sake, you know, please enable us to do the job we joined to do. We joined to be police officers. We know what we need to do. Just give us a ways that enables us to live and not to have to go out and beg on the streets or get money from other sources, where our families can live, can be fed, where we get health care, etc., etc., and give us the tools to do the job. That told us that there was a critical mass within the police service that was worth working with and supporting. The other thing is we had to get some fresh management in to some of the posts, and there were easily identifiable individuals who, for whatever reason, had been kept down. And because we're in a position to do it, particularly with Keith Biddle as being later on as the Inspector General, so he had operational and administrative control of the force, we were able to quickly bring some of these people up into positions of power, and therefore able to be effective and able to help the change process. And that was very effective. We had half a dozen people who we were quickly able to put into the senior officer ranks, and they worked extremely hard to bring in the changes that were required. Some of the other officers suffered. There were some corrupt, some incompetent, been put in for the wrong reasons, but quite quickly looking back that they were either retired or moved on elsewhere. And you had to do that across. You had to be careful who you put into where, because you're talking about political interference at that time rather than political involvement. Some of the politicians had to be very careful about who they approved and appointed because of their because of the need to balance and to be seen to be fair. And you had to, as well, train people. And one of the things we did, which cost a lot of money, but proved to be very worthwhile, is that we brought over a period of 2 or 3 years, something like 30 senior officers in that region to Bram's Hill in the UK. And they went through the International Commander's Course at Bram's Hill. And for the first time, many of these people were actually working together as a team. That proved extremely effective. They were introduced into new ways of policing, modern ways of policing, a lot of the management techniques, management training, together, and also with people from several other countries. They learnt a tremendous amount. When they came back, they were that much more effective and able to work together as a team. I think that's a very important point to make as well. So rather than sending off one or two and perhaps going different countries, different courses, different places, we actually sent them all to the same course. They all had the same training. They all had the opportunity to work and develop together. And it's those officers now who are in the positions of power within the Sierra Leone police, mm-hmm. And proving to be extremely effective. So you've got to think about the succession planning amongst all these things you have to think about. You've got to have a succession plan in place. You know, when this IG retires, you know, who's following on behind in 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years' time, who's had the right training, in the position to step into his shoes to ensure that all the work you've done in the past is carried on and developed and you have this sustainability. And there's several other issues we had to address with the senior officers. So the first was to put in place, which they did themselves very effectively, a strategic development plan. There's no point doing any of this work unless you're working to some sort of strategy. So they sat down between them, they thought about what it is that needed to happen, and they had a 3 to 5 year strategic development plan, which rolled on. So as certain things were achieved, then they then refreshed it every year. They worked a system of initially quite crude, but some sort of what are we going to do this year type plan, with some monitoring built into as well. And that became more and more sophisticated as time went on. And I was looking at the latest strategic development plan and the policing plan a few months back, and it's quite a sophisticated document now. It recognises that, you know, you can't do everything in one go. You've got to make sure that what you've done in the past is successful, all those sorts of things which lead to good change management. And they had to learn a lot of this. And we did some of that. They set up what they called the Executive Management Board. And every week the senior officers, heads of department of the police would meet, and we would be part of that. So we were able to sort of impart advice and impart ideas as they ran their force and moved it forward. And as I say, over a very short period of time, it became very effective and quite sophisticated. Calling for reports, calling for research reports, and thinking about things in the round rather than just singly. So we go back, say, to vehicles as the example. Now, it's no good thinking about getting 10 vehicles. How are you going to run them? What's the recurrent budget effect? You're going to have fuel for them. How are we going to get the spares? We've got to build that into the budget. And we've got to get budget support from the Treasury and other departments within government. So it was that level of thinking that became part of the organisational thinking quite quickly, which was very encouraging.
Mm-hmm. There's a few things I'd like to pick up on there. Firstly, getting back to what you're saying about picking up the junior officers who were who had quite a lot of potential and pulling them up. Was that basically, did you hand select them, or was there a reforming of a promotion system that made it possible for them to kind of rise in the ranks?
The promotion system was totally restructured, and it became one based on merit rather than the old-fashioned way of nepotism or political interference or whatever. So quite a revision of the whole promotion system, and officers and the staff appraisal system introduced, and not just introduced but checked, so that I think everybody who's been part of a staff appraisal system, you know, is realizes the weaknesses of it. You know, if somebody says, oh, this officer is first class and ready for promotion, you know, okay, right, we're going to promote him, but he's going to be your second in command. And they say, oh, no, don't want that, he's useless. I mean, yeah. So you've got to challenge people and do it. In the case of Sierra Leone, it was relatively easy to do because the size of the force and the size of the country, you quickly knew most of the people individually. So consequently, you were able to spot yourselves the people who wanted to do the right thing, who showed enthusiasm, who obviously had the ability to do it. So in Sierra Leone, relatively simple. In the DRC, it's a totally different kettle of fish, and that's a major problem that's going to have to be addressed. And there's no simple solution to that. But going back to Sierra Leone, it was. You could quickly spot the people who had potential, and then obviously help them. Again, you could select people for training, for management training, and we did send I don't know what the exact number is, but a number of people on, for instance, achieving scholarships. So they spent a year studying a relevant degree, either as a first or a second degree or whatever. In another country, for instance, Leicester University, two or three people went there for master's degrees or to on the Chevening scholarship facility. And they brought an awful lot back into the force. Again, able to study other forces, able to study how policing's developed in different countries, come back with new ideas. And it's worked extremely well. And some of those people are now in very senior positions within the force. So you got to, it's about long term planning. You've got to do a number of short term things. You've got to do some quick fixes. You've got all that sort of stuff to do. But it's got to be in the context of a long term plan, a strategic development plan.
Sorry, there was something I wanted to pick up on too, which was this idea of bringing, I think you said 30 people out to...
Something like 30,
For training here. Yeah. Something we've heard is that often what's more important than the training is, this, as you said, working as a team and this building up of a kind of esprit de corps or some sort of morale amongst the people who do that. Was that the case here?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And that's got a lot to do with political interference, political pressure. I mean, those 30 people didn't all come at one time. That spread over 3 years, I think. And as a group, as a team, they suddenly realised that they were far more powerful than the sum of the individuals. And you would get politicians pressurising an individual to do something which wasn't correct or, lose a case or whatever, or take somebody on or promote somebody or whatever. And political interference is not acceptable in democratic policing. Political involvement is, but not interference. And what we try to demonstrate, and they quickly realise, is that if, for example, through the executive management board, somebody asked for something to be done, an individual would find it very difficult to say no. But as a team, as a policy decision, no could be said. Because it wasn't down to an individual, it was a policy decision by, a cabinet decision, whatever you want to call it. It was a decision made by the team. And that helped, again, to build their confidence and to build, to a certain extent, courage to say no to things which they knew they were wrong. As an individual, they found it very difficult. As a team, then it was much, much easier to do. Mm-hmm. So it's building up, it's resistance to this pressure. But there's a problem there, and on any reform project, that I equate it to you build this pressure vessel, and it gets bigger and bigger and stronger to resist the pressure from the outside. Of course, at some stage that pressure may be too great and the whole thing blows up. So therefore, you've got to think, well, it's a two-way reaction. Yeah, we build the ability to resist the pressure, but through education of politicians and the public, you've also got to do something about reducing the pressure. So, you've got to... It's no point saying to police officers, a politician can't tell you what to do, a minister can't tell you what to do. You've also got to educate the minister or the member of the public or whatever, saying, well, you can't tell the police what to do. So it's wider than just internally within the police. There's a whole area of education, instruction, etc., that's got to take place within the other two corners of the policing triangle, the government and the public, because they've got to work together to ensure that you have a good, sort of democratic police service in the country. It's not just the police force, it's much wider than that. And that was an interesting thing that we had to address fairly early on, and we found what I think was a particularly good solution. Everybody was talking about, oh, we need community policing. But then you ask everybody, well, what does community policing mean to you? And we're fortunate in having all these different countries represented within the UN. And you'd say to to somebody say, well, what does community policing mean to you? Oh, we sit in the police station and we wait for a call and we get in our vehicles, we go and sort the problem out, and we come back to the police station. Oh, okay. What does community policing mean to you? Oh, zero tolerance. We don't allow any indiscretion at all. You know, we stamp on any crime, we stamp on any indiscretion, we stamp on anything. Okay. And you ask every single individual, what does community policing mean to you? And they'll come up with a slightly different answer. And their answer and the concept that the word implies will very much be reflected by their own experiences in their own country. So they want to put something in. If somebody's putting in community policing, they probably want to put something in which is based on their own experiences in the country, which is not suitable for any other country. You've got to find a solution that suits the needs of, in this case, Sierra Leone. We're going through the same process in Somalia and the same process in the DRC. So we stripped it right back to basics. And when we sort of just thought about it and talked to a number of people about it, we came up with this concept which we called local needs policing. And all it simply means is a system of policing that meets the needs and expectations of the local community, but delivered within national standards and guidelines. Because in any country, you're going to have both by time and by area the need for different types of policing. And it's got to be locally based. You can't say we're going to have this style of policing in Freetown, which is a big city, but in Kenema, which is a totally different environment, it's probably not going to work. It's got to be done within national standards and guidelines, things like compliance with human rights, national policies about prisoner handling. You've got the same laws across the whole country. But you've got to allow the devolved responsibility for people to make decisions at a local level. And that was quite a change, because in the past, you know, often most things were referred back to headquarters, who made a decision and then sent them back. Now, this is about policing decisions being made locally and not just involving the police. You've got to involve the community and you've got to involve government, whether it be national or whether it be local. So alongside this local needs policing, you've got to have an organisation which supports it, and that became known as the local command unit. And again, a simple structure, common to all police stations, whereby you had the man in charge, and then you had supporting disciplines, operations, crime, information, intelligence, and logistical side. And they would meet together on a regular basis, daily, hourly, whatever it needed, and say, right, what are the problems? Okay, what are we going to do about it? I mean, it's pretty simple stuff. Also, with the link into the community and the local police there in Sierra Leone sort of came up with the phrase partnership boards, so that alongside this new policing structure also sat a partnership board which liaised and worked very closely with the police to solve local problems. And that was quite a dramatic change. We piloted it in a village whilst the war was still on, called Waterloo. And the change was quite dramatic. So you move one day from a system where the police never talked to the council, never went out to the police station, very rarely talked to the public, to a completely different system, which everybody wanted, everybody expected, that we can actually talk to the police, we can work together to solve problems. And when you move from war to peace, the change will be quite dramatic. For example, when does a war crime become a criminal offence? You know, lots of women can be raped, or there can be mutilations, and people seem to think they can get away with it by calling war. But when that stops, you know, it then becomes a very horrific, nasty crime which has to be dealt with. But what you find is that when you move through war, and perhaps the village problem is one of rebels in their midst or whatever, suddenly that's all stopped, and then the problems become one of vehicle driving or kids playing in the street or something simple like that, and they're the main policing problems in a peaceful society. And many of these problems can only be solved by the public coming up with their own solutions. A particular one involved taxis in one area, I remember, in Freetown. And it was raised at one of these partnership board meetings with the police where they worked together. And the solution to the problem actually involved the taxi drivers' union, not the police, but the police, because of the system that had been set up, were able to act as the catalyst to find a solution to a difficult local problem. And there's many different examples on that. So local needs policing, we avoided the term community policing because it meant all things to all men. Mm-hmm. It's a community-based policing, but at the same time, it's individual to Sierra Leone. It's a Sierra Leone solution to a Sierra Leone problem. And you can adopt that, and it has been adopted in different places because it's so simple and so easy. You know, a system of policing that meets the needs and expectations of the local community, but make sure it's delivered within national standards and guidelines.
Mm-hmm. Would you mind talking a little bit more about these partnership boards and who was on them and, you know, how its members were selected and if that's the right way of thinking about them?
No, it's interesting because you're at a local level. If you take Freetown, for example, you had Kissy, one side of the city, and you had Congo Cross, for example, a different district, the other side of the city. Congo Cross was much more the business area, so the partnership board had much more representatives of business and was a different structure. You know, people who represented the makeup of the community that existed in that area. In Kissy, it was very different. You had the market women, for example. You had a lot more youth. There was much more in the way of trade through the docks and things like this. So you have representatives of the market women, the youth, the taxi drivers association. So it's a different structure, but it represented and most of these people were either established or were elected representatives of different groups, like the market women or the taxi drivers association. Who formed a small board, no more than sort of 12, 15, perhaps maximum 20 people, who had regular meetings with the local police organisation, formal meetings, and informally mixed all the time. And it was through these that, you know, problems didn't become big problems, you know, attempts were made to sort problems out at the earliest opportunity. And there was a much wider effort in sorting out the policing problems of their own area. It worked extremely well.
Mm-hmm. And did they have any kind of monitoring role on crime? I mean, was any information available to them to kind of judge whether the police were doing a good job in their particular area?
Well, they would know because they lived in the area. I mean, that's the beauty of it. So they knew when the police were doing a good job or when they're doing a bad job. And they in most cases, they soon made it known to the police that they weren't doing a good job. And also within the new system, slowly much more in the way of management information was introduced. But that's a difficult one. But over time, more management information is there, number of crimes, number of accidents, these sorts of things, so that you could identify problems. The police just picked up far more about what the issues and problems were. And they knew who to go and see if there was a particular problem. So they became far more knowledgeable of the people who lived in their area. They became far more knowledgeable of the general crime that was going on, for example, or whatever the problems were. And also involving the local council and local, because as I said, police is a three-way thing. It's the government, you know, it's the public and it's the police. And by involving local councillors, you know, sometimes you could find a solution if there's an accident place, you know, it might be due to a pothole or something. We'll get the pothole filled in and we solve the problem. So it's extraordinary. And the policemen liked it themselves because they actually felt far more involved in policing rather than sort of managing some whatever it was.
So, I mean, it sounds like there was a lot of support for this idea. Do you encounter any resistance from any sectors?
Very little.
Yeah.
Very little. In fact, I can't think of any. I mean, everybody wanted it. And that's what you find in a number of countries. At once, in Waterloo, and then we trialled it in Bow and somewhere else. And once people saw it and heard about it and saw what was happening, they all wanted it. So there was a demand for it, which is good. So it wasn't imposed. It, you know, people wanted it. They asked for it. And they wanted to make it work. And it was a real check on the police as well. You talked about accountability. The people in general had the ability to walk into a police station when they wanted. They could go into a police station, and I think we tried some lay visitor schemes. So in other words, the individuals could go and visit the cells, for example. Now you can't get much better accountability and check on policing than that, where somebody has the agreement with the police and the community as their representative to go in and check and make sure prisons have been treated properly, and see what's going on.
And to your knowledge, of this. This level of enthusiasm continued. I mean, are people still involved?
Oh, very much boards? So, yeah. In fact, I was at a conference in South Africa a few months back, and it was organised by JICA, Japanese organisation, and it was about African experiences of policing. And Sierra Leone was represented, and it wasn't actually a policeman who gave the presentation about policing. It was one of the chiefs, local chiefs. Which was quite amazing, and he was so enthusiastic about it. And one of the assistant commissioners was there, Murray Lengo, and he just sat back and let him get on with it. And when somebody asked him a question, he said, "Well, don't ask me, ask the chief." So it was it's really good to see.
Yeah, quite an endorsement.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's only now. I mean, we're now 10 years on since we started to introduce a lot of this stuff. It's only now that it's, and this gives an indication of the length of time you need to be involved in this stuff. 10 years on, and it's now that the police force and the community and whatnot themselves are driving this. They're making it happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that would obviously seem to be a clear sign of a successful initiative, you know, and something that's really worked well. Are there any other kind of, I guess, evaluation tools or measures that you could think of or use to, as you say, 10 years on, to look and see whether the police is where you would want it to be?
I mean, one of the best ways is obviously attitudinal surveys. We tried to start these, and that's a difficult science. It's not easy to do. But the measures over a number of years showed improvement, showed people thinking better about the police, the police feeling better about themselves, this sort of thing. To use measures like crime measures in a place which is just coming out of war is very difficult, because you've got to have proper recording systems, you've got to have proper recognition of what's a crime, you've got to have willingness of people to report the crime. So if you take crime, for example, you say, oh, there's going to be an increase of crime, and if the police are recording it, then it will show an increase. But is it an actual increase in crime, or is it an actual increase in the willingness of people to come and report crime to the police? And I firmly believe it's the latter. I mean, you're going to get an increase in reported crime, and recorded crime doesn't necessarily mean you've actually had an increase in crime. So using statistics like that is always very, very difficult. I think you just got to go. In many ways, it's not a very scientific approach. If you don't have really good attitudinal surveys and all the rest of it, you've got to rely on, for instance, reports from NGOs, and you've got to ask the "what didn't happen" question. This is a question people don't ask. So you say to people, "Well, can you remember the last two general elections in Sierra Leone?" The answer is no. Why not? Because they went well, they went smoothly, generally fair, generally extremely successful. A lot of it down to the fact that you had a police force that had been trained to manage the elections, that were in place, had the communications, transport, etc., to manage the elections. Very successful. So, right, nothing happened. But how do you measure that? Right. And ask the question, well, the The OSD, the inverted commas paramilitary wing, or the armed wing of the police force, 2,000 odd people. You know, when was the last time they shot and killed somebody who was not a robber or there wasn't a problem? Can't remember. You know, because it hasn't happened. Because they've been properly trained, because they've been properly equipped, because they've been properly managed, you don't get those instances of shooting, of human rights abuse, etc., etc. But you can't. Whereas, and previously they wouldn't have been recorded. There would have been more a case of rumour and innuendo and all the rest of it, but no doubt they happened. But you can't say, well, there were 10 committed there and one committed now. You can't say that because you haven't got the figures to do it. So, you know, I put a lot of faith in the what didn't happen question.
Sort of along these lines, were you involved with any attempt to build a more formal oversight system, an investigative agency or such like?
Yeah, I mean, again, the two things we did right at the very start was put in a media department, which we talked about before, and also put in a whole new complaints department. Mm. It was called the CDIID, Complaints Discipline Internal Investigation Department. Mm. And alongside that, we had to introduce a whole new set of discipline regulations, which is actually quite easy to do. We did it through the Police Council. They supported it. So we had a modern-day set of regulations and discipline regulations about what policemen can and cannot do and what the punishment would be if the regulations were abused. And there's a whole new department set up, whole new monitoring regime set up, all trained up again by a consultant from, experienced consultant from the UK. Very, very effective. Very, very effective. And the public soon knew that they could actually complain about police officers and something would be done about it. Mm. And because the proper monitoring procedures were put in place, and reports would go up to the Police Council, for example, there was that external oversight as well.
Mm-hmm. What the Police Council, could you talk about that?
Yeah, the Police Council, I mean, when we first got out there, it's pretty ineffective. The Vice President was chairman, you had the Minister of Interior, and you had three lay people on it as well, and the head of the police. Small group, and their job was to really oversee what was going on with the police, in theory, and also to support the budget-making process and make sure that they got provided with the sort of pay and rations that needed to run the police force. Mm-hmm. We worked closely with them, and over time, they too became quite effective as an oversight mechanism. And the Inspector General had to report to them on contentious issues, on you know, sort of progress reports and what have you. I believe it's still quite an effective oversight tool. And, of course, you've got accountability through the press, which goes back to the media department. And they're not slow in coming forward, the press in Freetown. If they get a sniff of something, they're straight in. And now they can actually contact the police direct. They don't have to wait. They can phone up somebody in the media department or whatever. And the freedom was given to senior officers to respond to the press, not to put it up, you know. So in other words, if there's a problem, to tackle it straight away and deal with it. And they had weekly media meetings with the press, therefore able to raise all these things in front of everybody, and everybody got the proper and right story. And sometimes the police were at fault, sometimes they weren't. But there was a mechanism for people to openly and transparently address these issues and say their piece. And also oversight through the Parliament, for example. I mean, the Inspector General, on occasions, was called to Parliament to account for whatever it was he had to account for.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the Inspector General had to report. Was that legislated?
I think it was contained in the Police Act, but a lot of the legislation was old and needed rewriting, and that was an issue. But we were able to work within the legislation that sat there, and the police council could call upon the Inspector General to report on certain things. Mm-hmm. Do you want another quick break?
Yeah, sure. Actually, yep. I was just about to suggest that. Okay, this is take two of part three of the interview with Adrian Horn on 5th of December 2007. We're going to pick up on a few sections that we haven't spoken about. So the first is this issue of integration and amalgamation of services. Often there may be existing services that you try to incorporate within a new civilian police force. And I understand that this was the case in Sierra Leone, and I'd like to know if you could share a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, in many ways there were two parts of the police in Sierra Leone when we first went there. The first part was the general policing, and I suppose all people saw of that really was the traffic police out on the streets directing traffic and trying to make a living. The other section at that time was what they call the SSD, the Special Security Division. And was also known as Shaka Stevens' Dogs. And that was the paramilitary wing of the Sierra Leone police and comprised about between 1,500 and 2,000 officers armed with army weapons, AK-47s, rocket-propelled grenades, a few gas guns and the like. Very effective fighting force. But had a legacy of criminality and what have you, because many of the people were recruited into the SSD during Stephen's time directly from the streets of Freetown, so they hadn't had police training, and the discipline and control was very lacking. Obviously, the police who are not generally armed do need an armed element to operate properly, particularly in a country like Sierra Leone, when at that time they were still in war, and as they came out of war, particularly where you wanted to put the military back in barracks. And they were, as I say, a very effective fighting force and were responsible for protecting, on more than one occasion, insurgents into Freetown and elsewhere. But in order for them to be part of the new police, if we can call them that, there had to be some great change, and they ultimately became known as the OSD, the Operational Support Division, and they had a number of elements within that. But the sorts of issues we found was because they were police and because they were responsible for the control of order, because you couldn't really use ordinary police officers at that time to control disorder, all they had to use was AK-47. So if you're faced with a problem of disorder on the streets, you had two choices. Either the policeman would go and try and contain the crowd, but as soon as the crowd became angry, then the policeman would disappear. You were then left with the OSD, or the SSD as it was then, with AK-47s to face the crowd. And that was the final option, which meant that in a riot situation, there was great potential for a lot of death, because military weapons would be turned on the crowd. So we had to do something about that. And in order to control disorder, you need a series of options, particularly non-lethal options. So in a fairly short period of time, we managed to bring in some equipment, we managed to do some initial training, we managed to get some good management in place within the OSD, which enabled these non-lethal options, a series of options. So you could go from simple cordons where policemen work together by hanging on to a policeman's belt or forming a cordon, whatever, but in a disciplined way, trying to control a crowd. If that became escalated into more violence, you then had the option of using batons. You then could fall back and use shields. You could then fall back and use plastic bullets or baton rounds or CS gas. And finally, if it had to come to that, then you would have to go back to your lethal option. But the point is, you're able to give a much stronger response to disorder without reverting to lethal weapons, which in most of the time would control a problem. And you had to change the weapons. I mean, an AK-47 and military ammunition are designed to kill as many people as possible in the shortest period of time, whereas a police weapon is an ammunition designed to stop an individual committing an offence or whatever. So there was a change over weaponry as well as time went on. So you finished up with a disciplined body of people, well controlled, highly trained in public order management techniques, and pretty disciplined in weapons control, rules of engagement, all those sorts of things. And they became an integral part of the police. And over time, they then became more part of the police in terms of general patrols and patrolling with the UN and whatever. And one of the successes of controlling disorder, particularly within Freetown, was actually working together with all the various agencies from the UN through to the Army, through to the OSD, through to normal police, and actually having a joint command centre that actually coordinated all the information and intelligence and communications of all these disparate bodies into one, so that you got a combined and coordinated response to any problems that might arise. And that proved extremely effective in stopping a lot of ad hoc violence or perceived violence from the different forces. So it's very important to integrate not just sections within the police, but certainly in operational problem areas, all the different bodies. In fact, we even had the Civil Defence Force within that department, so that non-state organisations were actually part of that. So we had much greater control of what was going on.
Hmm. There are a few things I'd like to pick up on there. Firstly, so did the OSD undergo a kind of separate retraining compared to the training of the new police?
Yeah, in many ways. Again, another consultant, Ray England, was responsible for that, and he had both a military and a police career in the past, so he was extremely able in retraining. And we brought in the Metropolitan Police to do some of the public order training as well on that. They also had instruction and training on things like human rights, because obviously it's very important that they understood human rights, that sort of thing. And they had some refresher training, but they were never trained, or most of them were never trained as police officers. And because of the function that they performed, at that stage, it wasn't necessary for them to undergo, a full police training course. The priority and the urgency was to get a disciplined armed body who you could rely on and control, ready to deal with disorder and the problems that obviously follows on in that sort of society.
And were there any sort of tensions between this unit and the rest of the kind of newly formed police?
I don't think so. I didn't pick any up. And over time, we started changing some of the commanders out with, so some of the traditional long-term OSD commanders would go into the other side of policing, and vice versa. Which started the integration process. They had a very different function, and at the time, and for several years, their work was cut out in patrols, in trying to maintain order within Freetown, in responding to intelligence where rebels were carrying out armed raids, joint patrols with the UN and other people to deal with armed robberies, that some of those were going on at the time. And as we worked through and did the training, then anybody who went into the OSD actually had to go through basic police training. So that was introduced at a relatively early stage. So when the people went through the training, the initial training course, then people were selected then to go into the OSD for specialist training in terms of firearms use and public order control, and then they became part of the OSD. And I think at that time, I think we were talking about a 2-year tenure of post policy, so that they'd only do a couple of years and then come back into the police. So we started getting a good changeover of individuals. And people didn't get into the rut of being an armed OSD officer rather than a policeman.
Okay.
Or women. There were women in that, of course.
And did you have any sort of vetting program at the beginning of this process, perhaps to weed out people with particularly bad records? Or
it was very difficult to do because there were no records. And you had to avoid going on the rumour and speculation because people would want people out for various reasons. You had to be quite careful. I mean, there were individuals who obviously weren't suited and had to go, but they were few and far between. Mm. And as the vetting processes that brought people into the police generally, they went through the initial training and then into OSD. You had some sort of filter at the beginning anyway on that. And all the time there were the monitoring, day-to-day monitoring of people was getting better and better, so that if anybody did fall out of line, then action could be taken quickly and properly.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned also that you had this kind of integrated organisational support system, and the Civil Defence Force was part of that?
The JCC, yes, it was... a coordination centre that we set up in headquarters, or England set up in headquarters, that brought together representatives of the army. There was a civil defence force, Camajors, the UN, the police, of course, and one or two others. And as a consequence, information was shared, intelligence was shared, communications were shared, and there were instances where, for example, somebody would phone up or call in and say, oh, somebody's causing a problem from the Civil Defence Force. Immediate action was taken, and it was often a case of somebody passing a message or the message going down the line from the representative within the JCC to say, oh, stop it. And the problem was stamped out right from, you know, before it became a problem.
And can you talk a little bit about the relationship between the police and the Civil Defence Force and how they regarded each other, and whether there was much kind of communication? And
that's Keith would probably be better to talk about that, because he would have day-to-day. Now, Keith would be better to talk about that.
Okay, fair enough. I'd like to, if we may, just talk a little bit about the reform process as a kind of general issue. Do you have any thoughts on kind of the sequence of steps that reformers perhaps should follow? Like perhaps what tasks should be done before others and what things shouldn't be attempted before certain systems are in place? Would you mind just talking a bit about that?
No, I'd love to, because this is something quite close to my heart. Having worked in this area now since 1994, I've seen lots of mistakes and lots of problems, and I have some strong views on that. Very much depends on the context in which you're working. I'm currently doing a little bit of work in Somalia, some work in the DRC, looking at designing and putting in a big police project there, and, of course, Sierra Leone. Three totally different situations. And the first thing that must be done is to understand the context in which you're going to work. It's no good anybody from any country going into a place and say, oh, we're going to put in a UK system, or we're going to put in a French system, or whatever. You've got to understand how things work and what makes the country tick. And in Sierra Leone in particular, it was very much a family thing. The family influence, the family ties were very strong. Of course, you had you then had the tribes, and then you had the ruling houses, and all these things you need to understand before you started interfering with any organisational setup, structure, or individuals. You need to understand the politics, you need to understand the economy, you need to understand the geographical dimensions, everything, before you should even start to attempt to come up with some sort of plan. Once you understand the context in which you're working, you must have some sort of strategic development plan. These days, there's absolutely no point in saying, oh, we'll go in and do some training. Training for what? Oh, we'll go and give them some vehicles or some communications. No doubt vitally needed, but without them being given in the context of a long-term plan of reform, then you're not quite sure, A, what they're going to be used for or how long they're going to last, or even if the country can afford to supply fuel, for example, to run them. If you don't have the management controls, you could easily find them being used as taxis, and that isn't a flippant remark. We often used to find vehicles sort of carrying wives and children and relations all over the place for fees. So you've got to have some sort of strategic development plan. The other thing now we feel very strongly with, and we did this in Sierra Leone, we've also done it with the senior police officers from Somalia, and we've done it with the civil society in the DRC, and it will also be done with the police as well. And that is, from a very early stage, is to get some sort of statement about what their values, intentions, policies, what they're going to do. Some sort of mission statement from the police, and in the case of Sierra Leone, we got from the president himself a charter, government charter, about what the government's going to do, what the government expects from its police, and what the government expects from its people to do in relation to policing. And we also ran the senior officers through a series of seminars to finish up with a statement of aims and values and those sorts of things from the police themselves, which they all signed up to. Over time, that proved extremely valuable because you could always refer them back to this and say, well, these are your standards. This is what you want. This is where you're heading towards. And, you know, everything that we do is working towards this. Alongside that, as I say, you've got to have this strategic development plan. So what do we want to achieve? What is it that we're going to do over the next 3 to 5 years to achieve that? Now, none of that is to say you can't have quick fixes. When we went into Sierra Leone, it was a very difficult time. We went in with a great deal of autonomy and some cash, and we could very quickly fix small things, like if they had a vehicle, and they had very few vehicles left at that time, but we could get them repaired pretty quickly. We could rebuild a police station or put a roof on it very quickly, these sorts of things. So you've got to have quick fixes. You've got to have things that you can do to show that you're intent on helping and you're not just another bunch of consultants coming over to give wise words and then clear off. You're actually going to help them in the process of reform practically and in terms of helping them develop these things. So, but once you've got the strategic development plan, that then should determine your the way in which you're going to work in terms as a donor. In the case of DFID, you have to go through a process of concept notes and project memorandum. And this is exactly what we did. So we got the strategic development plan, we put together a project memorandum which said that, you know, this is what needs doing over the next 3 years and this is basically what it's going to cost. Once you get the approval, you can then action that. The next stage is that you've got to develop some good action plans to deliver what you've said in the strategy. And that is a process that you must go through. Otherwise, you'll finish up with bits and pieces going on all over the place with no coordination and no clear monitoring and no clear aim of where you're going to go. So what we did in Sierra Leone and what should be good practice in any big project is some sort of project management methodology. And the extent to which that conforms to PRINCE2, which is the UK government's standard, you have to think about, and again, you have to work within the context in which you're working. Clearly, you can't have a very sophisticated system of computer-linked reports generated for this, that and the other if the infrastructure doesn't exist to help you to do that. But you've got to have some sort of methodology which enables you to monitor how action plans are being implemented, what stage you've reached, the sorts of problems that you come up against and what you've done to resolve those, and all the other myriad problems that arise as you go through a particular set of actions. Now, if you get all that in place, so if you build up a knowledge of the country, a good contextual analysis, you have a good strategic view from the people themselves, the country themselves, about where they want to go, from the people's point of view, from the government's point of view, and from the police point of view. You have some sort of strategic development plan written, and you have the donor backing and, where necessary, the donor coordination to deliver that plan, and you have proper action planning, your next stage is to make sure you've got the right people to do the job. And this is, it's quite apparent that the success or otherwise of a project can very much depend on the individuals who are selected to either be consultants or to run it. So great care has to be taken to get the right people in place to do that job. And then you've got to have the commitment for long term. None of this stuff is going to work if you're talking about a year or 2 years, because people will come at you with a shopping list and they will be very nice to you, and they'll take everything that's on offer, knowing that you're going to go away in 2 years' time. Make sure that people understand that there is a commitment for probably 10 years at least, possibly longer, because it's going to take that long before you see any real sustainable result on your activities.
Well, that's very neatly outlined. Just along these lines of the reform process, you've mentioned that context is particularly important. I was wondering if you could tell us perhaps about one or two cultural differences that have required you to perhaps modify a project's proposal, something that was either not acceptable in a country or needed to be changed because of a particular cultural context.
Yes. I could talk quite a bit about witchcraft, because we found that quite interesting. But one of the stories I can't relate. But on that theme, it was interesting that we set off on a. We set off on a project, or part of the project, about setting up sexual abuse, violence abuse referral centres, and about training the police how to deal properly with complaints from women in society, and also deal with abuse of children and what have you. And it was all very right, it felt very right, and we started training police officers. And I remember sitting down one day at dinner with another senior police officer, and after the first and second course, I think it was, he says, Adrian, he says, what are you doing? I said, what do you mean? He says, you know, my wife, you know, she's getting reluctant to cook my tea and have my food on the table when I get home, and I can't admonish her. I said, why? He says, well, so just think about what you're doing culturally. You know, for hundreds of years, and even within customary law, it's permitted to beat your wife. And it's expected that the wife does the cooking and has the meal on the table and so on and so forth. You know, just bear in mind when you're doing this stuff that you're interfering with culture and with tradition that goes back time immemorial. And that made me think quite hard. And as a result, we actually hired in a social anthropologist. I mean, for a policeman to think of social anthropology as a as a skill to use in addressing police reform projects. But he came back with stuff which was extremely interesting. And as a result, I think the big lesson and message to come out of that was that when you actually do something which is interfering with culture and interfering with tradition, you need to really understand what the effect of that is, what the long-term effect and what the side, the repercussions are right across the things. You've got to do a lot of thinking, a lot of planning when you start doing some of these projects and some of these activities, because if you aren't careful, you might do more harm than good in implementing something. So the message is you must, and we come back to the contextual analysis, you must understand the context in which you're working and what you're doing. But it's also interesting from the social anthropologist what he had to tell us when he came back from going into a few villages and researching in depth. And that was the problem with the whole justice system and the lack of access to justice by, you know, the general person in the village. And what he told us was quite worrying, actually. And what happened was that when the rebels came in into this particular village, that several of the community actually rode on the back of the rebels to get their vengeance out on people who had offended them or wronged them over time. Because otherwise they had no access to either traditional or state justice at all, because they didn't have the money to pay the chief, or they didn't have the money to pay the policeman to undertake an investigation or whatever. So the only way they can get revenge or to seek reprisal was to actually ride on the back of the rebel invasion and to get rid of their frustration that way. And also what he told us was that frustration was building again, because whilst we were concentrating on the police, at that stage there was very little going on about the other elements of the justice system. So the other big lesson, I think, which I've learned over the years, is that you cannot deal with one without thinking about the other. So if you're going to improve the efficiency of the police, and you're going to improve the efficiency, for example, of prisoner handling, where the law says that you must only detain, for example, a prisoner for 48 hours, then you've got to address the problem, well, what happens after 48 hours? That person has to go somewhere, he has to go before the court. If he's going to be remanded, he has to be remanded in prison. So you've got to address issues like availability of courts, of magistrates, of prison spaces, all the aspects that cover the wide range of justice sector reform, rather than looking specifically at police reform. And that is a very, very big issue. And it's good to see that with the, for example, with the OECD Manual of Guidance on Security Sector Reform, that a lot of people have now taken that on board. And certainly my experience working in these various countries is there's a lot more thought given now to addressing these issues as a whole, rather than specific items like police or courts or justice or prisons or whatever. And that's the way it's going to have to be done, because what you do in one area obviously has knock-on effects on the other. And we come back to the point that you're raising the expectations that somebody's going to be dealt with properly and fairly within the police. Their expectations are that will follow through the whole criminal system, and the reality is that those expectations won't be met unless you addressed all the other issues as well, and that could be worse than doing nothing in the first place.
Well, I'm keeping an eye on the time, and I think that's an excellent note to end on.
Excellent.
And I'd like to thank you very much for giving us so much of your time and so much of your experience.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.